Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Troy Hunt, security expert and also my friend, calling in from Australia. How are you, sir?
G'day, mate. I am good.
You just, if I understand correctly, spoke to the United States Congress, and you're not even from here. How did that happen?
I know. I was worried they'd find out. But no, it was an amazing thing, actually. So I had some folks from this House Energy and Commerce Committee reach out back in about September wanting to talk about Equifax, because that was a big news story. They wanted to talk about how data breaches were happening so that they could then grill the CEO of Equifax. Which they did in Congress, and then they popped up a little bit later and said, hey, how about you hop over and chat about data breaches and what it means to our ability to do knowledge-based authentication.
Mm. Is that, like, I don't think that talking tech with what I assume are highly non-technical Congress people, it sounds super exciting. Were they more or less, for lack of a better word, clever or educated about this than you thought they would be?
You know, it's interesting that the mechanics of the way it works is that the folks sitting there, when you see a testimony in progress, the folks sitting there asking questions, you know, the important mm-hmm. people in the suits, they're asking questions that other people have prepared for them, that their staffers have prepared for them. And mm-hmm. I didn't realize that until I went over there. So in one way, it's a little bit hard to tell because a very insightful sounding question could have actually been written by someone else. But then at the end of the day, they're there being the face of that question and having the discussion with you, and they need to understand what they're talking about. And to be honest, everyone that I did speak to there, both on camera, on the record, and afterwards as well, they were very switched on. They were genuinely interested, and frankly, everyone's just lovely.
Oh, well, that's comforting to know.
I know, you sound surprised, right?
Well, I mean, that was good. There's a certain levels of quality expectation and education in government right now, I think is I don't think about my member of Congress as being a cybersecurity expert and educated enough to help me. So that's good that you're there to help them.
Yeah, and that's it. And look, I think for me, that was the takeaway. It's like, this is important enough that they actually want to spend time talking about this. And look, we all like to throw shade at governments all over the world, and not just at yours, but at ours as well. And at the end of the day, these are people trying to do a job with a lot of issues on their plate. And I'm just glad that they saw this one as being important enough.
Mm-hmm. So I have just gone to your website, the website that you're the most well-known for. Certainly TroyHunt.com is a wealth of resource. But I'm at HaveIBeenPwned, that's PWNED.com. I put in my email address, and it tells me that I'm pwned on 17 breached sites and one paste.
Well, you're beating me. Congrats.
So can you explain to me why that's bad and maybe – what's going on here?
Yeah. So look, HaveIBeenPwned is a data breach aggregation service. So when we have a data breach that occurs and our data, and I'm in a dozen myself, our data is picked up and it's spread around the web as part of this big corpus of breached accounts, I aggregate that and I put it in one place and I make it searchable so you can figure out your exposure. So, you know, when I look at my account, I'm in things like the LinkedIn data breach. So LinkedIn had a data breach back in about 2012. The data popped up in 2016 and started circulating. I grabbed that, put it in the system. Everyone who subscribes to the service as a free subscription thing gets an email address, says, hey, we've just found you somewhere. And then you can come along later on and go, hey, well, what is my exposure? Where have I been pwned?
Hmm. And I'm in Dropbox, I'm in LinkedIn, I'm in Tumblr, but I don't know which password is taken. So what do I do? Just Like, I know that we have all, surely you also have reused a password once or twice in your life.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Look, I mean, I have seen data pop up before. I've seen my password, and I've just gone, oh, my God, what was I thinking? You know, like, we have all been there. The question about which password, et cetera, is interesting. And I think what's particularly curious about Have I Been Pwned is the way it drives awareness of the problems of things like passwords. So what I see happening the whole time is I'll load data into this system. So I want to get an email and it'll be like LinkedIn. And they'll go, oh man, like I've just realized that LinkedIn password is the same one that I'm using everywhere else. And it's the same one that I'm using on my email address, which is the thing that people can get into and then reset all of my accounts. So, you know, like bad news all around. So I love the fact that Have I Been Pwned is sort of the educational piece that hits home like nothing else for your normal, average, everyday consumers who can come there, put their email address in, and then suddenly realize just how risky it is to reuse credentials.
Mm-hmm. It says 17 breached sites and one paste. What is a paste?
So a paste is basically just a block of text which is dropped in a publicly accessible service like Pastebin. So there's Pastebin, there's another one called Slexi, there's Ghostbin, there's a bunch of these services which are just designed to share blocks of text. And you and I might use that to share a code snippet or something with each other. Bad dudes often use that to dump a whole bunch of credentials from a data breach. And very often, actually, we see Pastebin being used to put little samplers of data breaches out there. So it'd be like, look, here's, you know, say 10,000 records from a much larger breach. And it often becomes the canary in the coal mine for when there is actually a data breach. So I draw data from a Twitter account called Dumpmon, which goes and scrapes Pastebin, looks for patterns to establish what might be data breach-like behavior for a paste. And when I find that, I pick that up, I pull it into Have I Been Pwned, and I send an email to any of my subscribers who might be in there.
Ah, okay. I'm looking at Dumpmon, and it seems to be quite active, though. I mean, it's seeing emails. It might be 10 emails, it might be 100, but it's happening every 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah, look, it's nonstop. And in fairness as well, some of this stuff is not necessarily a data breach. There's logs in there. There's in some cases, there's source code repositories and stuff like that, where there's just email addresses that have appeared in that block of text. But very frequently, when you go through and look at that Dumpmon account, you go to a particularly Pastebin link and you go, yeah, that's credentials. You know, that's usernames and passwords. Mm-hmm. We see a really good example is I see Spotify stuff pop up there the whole time. And this is not necessarily Spotify having a data breach, but it's lists of email addresses and passwords that work on Spotify because people have reused their credentials. So someone will dump a bunch of them in Pastebin and then go, hey, give me a slice of Bitcoin and I'll give you more.
Oh, okay. How do you know? I mean, are you manually looking at these? How is this like wired together? Is it just regular expressions and wishes?
Yeah, pretty much the latter. And I'm sort of quite clear about that. So I've kind of diverged in two different directions here with Have I Been Pwned. So there's the obviously the data breach side of it. So you mentioned LinkedIn and Dropbox. These are major incidents, verifiable, high degree of confidence, they're legitimate, tens, hundreds of millions of accounts in there. And then there's the Pastebin side of it, which is, look, it's just a crawler. You know, it's just going through indexing stuff. If you find yourself in there because you search Have I Been Pwned or you get a notification, go and look at the paste and figure out whether it's something you need to be worried about or not.
Mm-hmm. I went looking for the paste that I'm found in and the website is down and now the domain has been taken over by someone that's not the paste person.
Right. So that's also possible. So there's some arbitrary paste where if I find stuff just laying around on the internet that is paste-like, sometimes I'll drop in an arbitrary URL. And that may be on a host name which disappears at some time. And when you sort of think about the nature of some of this data, it's like, yeah, I can see why that would get pulled offline, you know, why that may not be there tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the very bottom of Have I Been Pwned, and it says 4.8 billion accounts.
Oh, no, that's insane, isn't it? You know, it's when I started this service, so this is back in December 2013, I started it with the Adobe data breach, which was about 150 million accounts, and a few other really small ones. And I was like, man, this is crazy. There's like 150 million accounts in there. And then it was only last year. So we're recording this at the end of 2017. It was only in about the middle of 2016 that I passed the first billion. And I remember because I was at NDC in Oslo, and this was like part of the talk. It was like, let's flick the switch. And it's like, do we celebrate or cry that we just hit 1 billion? So I've gone in the space of just the last year of running it from 1 billion to 4.8 billion, the last year and a half, which is just like, I see this every day and it blows my mind that there is just so much data flowing into this system.
Did you have experience in building a site that could handle that kind of data? Because I assume that the scale needed to make Have I Been Pwned, it's not just scale on a person, you know, on traffic hitting it, but the back end must be terabytes.
I didn't have experience doing it on the cheap. So my experience was when I stood Have I Been Pwned up, I still had an architecture role in Pfizer. So I was like, all right, we're building big systems and it's a multi-billion dollar company and there's lots of money for things we need to do. And I started building Have I Been Pwned as we were really diving into Azure within the organization. And I'm like, you know, let's just, we'll do a hobby project, you know, play with the technology a little bit, you know, see what it does. And for me, that the challenge has become, how do I create something that's getting bigger and bigger and bigger for the cheapest possible amount of money? And to me, that's a bit of a game, you know, that's a bit of fun. So that was a new experience for me.
Yeah. I even though I, you know, work for Microsoft in my day job and talk a little bit about Azure, I explain to people that I talk to that I pay for my Azure sites with my own money. And you probably shouldn't trust a Microsoft engineer or anyone who's trying to sell you something if they have free Azure time, right? Because they're going to treat you differently. So I wrote a bunch of blog posts called Penny Pinching in the Cloud.
Yeah.
And if I can, you know, if I can run 20 websites on one small, well, that's free compute. So yeah. I would assume you're not making money on Have I Been Pwned other than giving talks about it. You'd want to make it as cheap as possible.
Well, you know, I remember reading that series of yours, actually, and it was, I liked that term. And I think there's a little bit of the engineer in us, which is kind of like, this is a challenge, right? Like, how big can I make this thing for how cheap? Mm-hmm. So it's interesting the way Have I Been Pwned sort of evolved over time. So one of the things that happened maybe about a year into it is people said, you should put a donations link, you know, like you should let people give you money. And I was sort of going, well, why would they give me money? It's free. And people are like, no, seriously, they will. So, okay, I put a donations link on there. And I thought, you know, I don't want to be sort of sleazy about it. I'm not just going to go, please give me money. I thought what I'll do is I'll say, look, I do this out of my own free time. I pay for the, you know, whatever costs, et cetera, come out of my own pocket. I spend a lot of time away from my family. Wouldn't it be nice if you bought me a movie ticket or take the kids to the movie? Or, you know, I spend a long, hard day. Yeah, buy me a beer. And I put that on the donations page. Right. And it was just sort of, I guess, more interesting, tangible stuff. And I started getting a lot of donations for it. So, you know, to this day, I get donations that certainly well and truly cover all the costs of it, which is actually surprising and fantastic. And then the other thing that's happened over time as well is there's been more companies that have popped up and said, look, for example, we're an identity theft company. In fact, I wrote about this at the time. A company popped up, said, we do identity theft monitoring. We would really love to be able to access this data because we have got 40 million subscribers in the case of MyLife, who are the ones I wrote about. MyLife said, look, we would love to be able to tap into this data because we've got 40 million people that we can reach and let know about these incidents. And you know, to my mind, I thought, well, that's great. Like, that expands the awareness. So when they popped up, I started making some information available to commercial subscribers. And this is not, you know, you won't find a buy now link or anything on the site. It's not like you go there and give me money.
Couldn't they do it? Couldn't they just do it without asking you?
No. And there's a few reasons for that. So one of the reasons is that in more recent times, and this is partly an effort to keep costs down and partly to keep ethical use, I've made the service rate limited. So you can only make one request to that database every 1.5 seconds. So basically the max that a human would want to do on the interface. So I've done that. The other thing is I've always made sure that certain data breaches are never publicly accessible. So for example, if you're a listener who was in the Ashley Madison data breach, you will not be able to go to the front page and find Ashley Madison in the results. You will be able to go and subscribe to the notification service, which is free, and you get an email with a verification token in it, and then you go after you've proven that you control the email, and it will say, yeah, look, you're in Ashley Madison. So that's never been available either. And over time, as it's sort of unfolded, there's been organizations that do things like provide B2B style services in the security space. So they'll say, look, we're a security company. We have a bunch of organizations that use our services. They'd love to be able to access this data on a domain level. So that's something that you can do for free on the public site if you can control the domain. And it's something that some subscribers get access to commercially if they've got customers that that need this information but can't necessarily prove they control the domain.
Oh, okay. Did that change the way that you originally architected and scaled the site? Because I'm thinking naively, you just hold 4 billion password accounts, you know, pwned accounts into a hash table, and there you go. Now you got a website. But then if you're doing things by domain, if you're doing things with notifications, that are, suddenly you're thinking about a much more complicated site.
So it boils down to the partitioning of it. So the underlying data structure for all of this is Azure Table Storage. And that's what it was when I started back in the day. It's still exactly the same structure today. I'm starting to look at Cosmos a little bit more now, but that's another another discussion. But the way I designed the table storage is I said, look, what I'm going to do is this is just going to hold email addresses. This is all it is. I'm going to make every partition the name of the domain. So there is a really, really big gmail.com partition. And then the row key of every record is going to be the alias. So that made things really, really super fast to look up by individual email address because we know exactly which partition to go to and exactly which row to go to. And usually the lookups, even amongst those 4.8 billion records, are single-digit milliseconds. But it also means that if I want to go and pull an entire domain, I just grab the partition. Now, I can't really do that for Gmail. It's just too big. But for 99.x% of domains, we can go, look, just return the whole partition for troyhunt.com or whatever it may be. And yeah, even when there's hundreds of thousands of records in there, that still works quite well.
Okay. Well, let me pivot a little bit because as I scroll through your blog, which is like 70 pages of information on data breaches and HTTPS and your Pluralsight courses and all the different things, I get the same feeling that I get when I go to anyone's security site who is a security expert is I think to myself, we're all going to die and it's probably, probably my fault as a programmer. I'm trying to get a sense of like how freaked out I should be. Like I read a blog post of yours on a thing that was a honeypot or something. It was called a pineapple.
Yeah, Wi-Fi pineapple. Well, yeah, they're kind of two different things. Look, the Wi-Fi pineapple, if anyone's listening and they don't know what this is, just Google my name and Wi-Fi pineapple and you'll see it. But it's a rogue wireless access hotspot, or can be a rogue wireless hotspot. And all it is it's a little device you can buy off a company called Hack5. It's $100 for the nano one, which is the cheaper one. Mm-hmm. And you power it via USB, so you can literally just plug it into your PC, and then you can create your own hotspot. And you might call it free cafe Wi-Fi. And if you call it anything free, people will connect to it. I go to conferences sometimes, part of the talk, I'll call it free NSA Wi-Fi. People will connect to it because they see free and then they go, yeah, that's it. I'm in. Like I'm sold. And now you have traffic routed through a device that you control. And then you could route that back out through your own internet connection. And the reason I show this device is that this allows us to have a discussion about man in the middle and why HTTPS is so important in a very impactful evidence-based way. So I've found this has been an awesome device for trying to get people realizing that something like a man in the middle is not a hypothetical threat. It's not just like a nation state actor kind of threat. It's like, yeah, someone bought one off the internet for $100 and now they have your traffic. So it's impactful that way.
Is it, you say that HTTPS is so important. Even if I connect to your free NSA Wi-Fi, what can you snoop about me? Can you get my Exchange passwords? Can you get my Gmail passwords? Or can you not because they're over HTTPS?
Yeah, it's the latter. So anything that's sent over an encrypted connection is solid. Now, there's lots of nuances here. And in fact, I reckon this year, this has almost been the year of all the different things I've spoken about where HTTPS has been the one thing that's changed so much and has also become so important. So, yeah, what's really critical here is that we're really rushing headlong into a secure by default internet. And at the moment, we're still sort of in that legacy era of things defaulting to insecure. And I'll give you a couple of good examples. If you go, as of today, to CNN.com, you'll see nothing in the address bar to indicate any sort of degree of insecurity. If you go to, let's say, TroyHunt.com, you'll see there's a green padlock and there's a green text and it says secure. And the really interesting observation here is that security is a very explicit visual indicator. And the only reason we know something is not secure is because it doesn't tell us that it is secure. And it's almost like that is our default position. You get no security. Just the same way as if you type CNN.com into the browser, it's going to make an HTTP request. And at some point in time, they'll go HTTPS and then it will manually 301 redirect and you'll get the secure page. But it's still going to try insecure first. And that, look, there are mechanical reasons why it needs to do that as well. But it's just interesting the way it's been so insecure. But where we are today is now we're up to almost about 70% of all traffic on the web being served over HTTPS, which is good. And that last 30% gap is being closed really quickly.
But the even myself as a fairly technical person, I still find certificate management a hassle. Sometimes I forget when I need, I'll have an obscure site or a small site that I run and the certificate will expire and I'll be like, oh crap, I got to go and deal with it. Are those problems solved or being solved?
So this was sort of getting us into the what are the barriers to HTTPS sort of realm. Right. And the two barriers that are, I think, are pretty closely linked here are cost and management effort. Mm-hmm. And if we scroll back, let's just scroll back only 2 years. If you wanted a certificate, you usually had to pay for it. It was usually about $70 a year. There were some CAs you could go and get them for free if you're a not-for-profit. And then you'd have to go and get the certificate, and it might be in the wrong format. And then you'd have to go and download OpenSSL, and you'd have to recompile it.
You're singing my life. That's exactly what I have to do. And then I have to go and RDP into a Windows machine and set it up manually. It's horrible.
I wrote a blog post a few years ago about how to get a free certificate on Azure website, and it was using a company called Startcom, who no longer exists, but it's another story. And the blog post was like, here are all the steps involved, and people were like, this is really useful. Thank you for writing it for me. It's like, mate, it's not for you. It's for me, so I remember how to do it when I have to come back and do it next year because it was so painful.
It's funny. I think people who – I mean, you and I have both been blogging for many, many years. I think people forget – they think that we are doing that for the people when it's pretty clear we're doing it for ourselves.
It's total self-interest.
Almost all my blog posts are me writing instructions that I will then go hunt for later.
But hey, this is the great thing too, because we have the same problems that everyone else has. So look, I mean, that was painful. The effort of that was hard. And then we get to the cost side of things. And, if you had someone who was either a small shop or a personal blogger or something like that, $70 a year may not seem like much, but it is a financial barrier. And people are saying, well, I don't want to pay $70 a year. So there's two things that have happened over that last couple of years that have really fundamentally changed the management effort and the cost effort. And probably the first one worth mentioning here is Let's Encrypt. So Let's Encrypt is a free, not-for-profit entity, which is backed by the likes of Mozilla or EFF, and they make certificates available for free. And they do so in an automated fashion, which means that if you want to get a Let's Encrypt certificate on, say, a Linux box, if you can shell into that machine, run a command, it will automatically verify that you can control the website that's on that box. It will download the certificate. And then it will set up a cron job to go back and renew that certificate every 3 months because they do 3 month certificates. Mm-hmm. So it's like run this command, you're done, and you just don't think about it again. And there's nothing wrong with their certificates. Yeah, this is not like, oh, it's free. It's not as good as paying Komodo money or something like that. That's not how the mathematics works.
Did they just destroy the market then? Does that mean that there's just no market for anyone else?
Well, this is going to get controversial now. So this has had a major impact on the market because if we go back only 2 years ago, Let's Encrypt really only started issuing certificates to the general public in about April 2016. So go back to, say, end of 2015, 2 years before recording, Komodo had, I think it was about 40% of the market, like a massive slice. And then Let's Encrypt came along and people were like, this is cute. We'll see how this goes. Maybe we don't really trust it. Mm-hmm. Fast forward through to today, they're now larger than Komodo in terms of the total number of certificates they've issued. that are active today, which is insane. So, you know, now we've got Let's Encrypt becoming the big guys, and this is having a really severe impact on the commercial CAs because they're going, hang on a moment, we used to make money out of this. Mm-hmm. So the discussion now has become really interesting, where we're seeing that the commercial folks try to move more towards commoditization models. I'm not choosing my words carefully here because you'll see why in a moment. They're trying to figure out ways they can make money out of it. And one of the ways they're doing this is they're saying, you should not get a DV certificate, you should get an EV certificate. And what they're saying here is that if you go to a site like TroyHunt.com, you see a padlock and it says secure and it says TroyHunt.com, but you don't know whether that is a good site or a bad site. All you know is it's the domain that you went to. Mm-hmm. In fact, I remember I've quoted you actually in one of my blog posts.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
So you wrote this epic tweet, which was something like, all you know is you're having a secure discussion. You could be having a discussion with Satan, right? Mm-hmm. So the value proposition of an EV certificate, an extended validation certificate, is that if you go to say, have I been pwned, you'll see it literally says, have I been pwned up in the address bar, and then it's got my name in brackets. So it's telling you that there is a legal entity called Have I Been Pwned, and I just went and registered a cheap business name here in Australia. And then who owns that legal entity if there is a parent, which in this case is me. And you can see that certificate and you can see that visual indicator and go, okay, well, look, I know that this is the actual company site that I'm looking at the moment. So that's the way they're now trying to make their money.
So I'm looking on your site, it just says secure. It doesn't say Troy Hunt. But if I go to Have I Been Pwned, it says Have I Been Pwned, Troy Hunt. It's longer, it's green, it's indicates security and presumed trust.
Well, yeah, now this is where it gets really interesting. And here's a good game for the listeners as well. The commercial CAs will say you should have an EV because an EV does imply trust, right? It will give people a greater level of trust. They will respect your site more. They'll sign up more. They'll give you more money, yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the problem. If this is the case, then you would assume that big sites would want to have EV. Mm-hmm. But see how many of the world's top 10 largest websites have EV. So, for example, Facebook. So for the listeners at home, does Facebook have an EV certificate without looking? No, it doesn't. What about Google? No, Google doesn't. What about Amazon? No, Amazon doesn't.
Yeah, and I'm hitting a bunch of sites here. New York Times, nothing.
I know, right? It's like it just simply doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. But it does exist on some services some of the time. So Twitter's a really good example. I put a tweet out, this would have been about the middle of the year, said, look, isn't it interesting? Here's the top 10 sites. And I had a little screen cap of all the tabs and none of them had EV. And one of them was Twitter. That was the 10th largest site. And then a whole bunch of people came back and said, well, hang on a second, Twitter does have EV. And here is a screen cap. And then this guy in Norway said, no, it doesn't. Here's a screen cap. And what we actually discovered is that Twitter, depending on where you are, was serving up an EV versus a DV certificate. But here's the big insightful part of this. I go to all these different places where Twitter does and does not have an EV certificate, and I had never noticed. And I look for this stuff, right? I'm sort of going, hang on. If I don't know when it does or it doesn't, and everyone listening doesn't know either, and I know you don't know because I ask this question every time I do a workshop, then does it actually change your behavior in the absence of an EV certificate? Because this is the argument, right? The CAs will say, well, if you don't have an EV certificate, people won't trust you as much. Well, actually, no. Frankly, we're doing a good job if people even look for the padlock.
It's interesting that you say that because I used to work in banking and, you know, you and I are talking in end of 2017, early 2018. I'm looking at a blog post that I wrote in October of 2006. So we're talking 11 years ago when EV certificates were still coming out and it was a big deal. You had to actually go and, you know, visit the data center and be audited. Like it was hard to get one, right? And say what you will about Internet Explorer, but they were trying to push these EV certificates so much so that they would light up the entire top bar in bright green if there was an EV certificate. And now here we are 11 years later. It's supposed to be a secure web. And frankly, the green in Chrome here, you know, could be kind of a gray black. It doesn't really stand out. If they really were serious, why don't they light up the whole bar?
Well, part of the problem is not so much what do you show when an EV certificate is present, but it's what do you show when it's not present? Because really what you're trying to say here is that if you go to a site and it doesn't have an EV certificate, you shouldn't trust it as much. And this is, again, is one of these problems where you're trying to get people to change their behavior in the absence of some form of visual indicator. And look, I mean, we know how hard it is just getting users not to click through and ignore security warnings. You know, like how much harder do you think it is to say, hey, when you go to a website and you don't see this thing, you know, don't trust it. And also we can't condition people to that because most of the websites out there and most of the world's largest websites don't have one anyway.
Mm-hmm. It's funny that you mentioned that because I actually did a blog, I did a podcast rather with Adrienne Porter-Felt, who does the usability security for Chrome. She's a PhD and a security researcher at Google. I did a podcast with her, episode 486, and she talked about doing all the user testing and A/B testing to find out how can we keep people from clicking past those security warnings. And she also told me something interesting. Do you know what the number one cause of security warnings is? You're going to love this. It's people changing their clocks forward to try to get more coins in games like Candy Crush.
This is where we are.
And this is where we are, which is tragic because we are at the end of our show.
Oh, man, what a sour note to end on. But,
I think the great note is, though, that if you go to troyhunt.com, you've got workshops and speaking. You're all over the world, and people can learn about security from you.
And because of things like this, I have a long and fruitful career ahead of me. So thank you, everyone, for putting your clocks forward for Candy Crush.
You will never not have a job. Yep, I'm looking at your upcoming events. You're in Australia. You're in London. We'll be in London together in a couple of weeks.
You betcha.
And you're all over the world. And I appreciate you. And thanks so much for coming on the show.
Good on you. Thanks, mate.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes. And we'll see you again next week.